This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Today on Masters in Business, I am thrilled to have had the opportunity to sit down and chat for an hour or so with Laszlo Borini. You probably recognize his names. Any of you folks who work in the industry and follow his research certainly know what a true historian and data-driven scholar he is. Borini has probably debunked more classic Wall Street memes than anybody else I know. He's challenged everything from AAII sentiment, which he shows to have zero meaning in forecasting future stock market movements, to his criticism of technical analysis, to the way he actually looks at historical data and uses it to help facilitate what does and doesn't happen in markets. He's been dead right, not only before the financial crisis, but since. He's been pretty steadfastly bullish from 666 all the way up to 2000 on the S&P. But more than that, I find him to be very insightful and rigorous and logical, which is not something I could say for many of the analysts who are on Wall Street. It seems like people tend to assume certain things or take for granted certain issues that don't hold up when they're looked at very closely. And that's what Borini really specializes in. When he was at Salomon Brothers, he pioneered the study of flow and looked at both how block trades and how trades that take place on either the bid or the ask, some people call that money flow, how that impacts stocks and what it might mean for short-term movements. He's just a really interesting, really insightful guy and does a nice job explaining some really inside baseball sort of technical things in a way that's understandable to anybody. So without further babbling on my part, let's go right to the conversation with Laszlo Borini.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, I'm thrilled to have Laszlo Borini. You may or may not know Laszlo from his many television appearances over the years. Let me give you a quick rundown of his background. Interesting academics, undergraduate at UNC Chapel Hill, history and computer programming. That's a unusual combination. Then you got your MBA at NYU. In 1976, you joined Salomon Brothers, head of equity market analysis. And while you were at Sally, you created the Salomon Russell International Index, Stock Week, the firm's weekly market commentary, Equity Desk, the training course for Salomon's traders. And last, and perhaps most important, your analysis of block trades led to the creation of Money Flow Analysis. Laszlo Borini, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So that's quite an interesting background. In the middle of that run, let's see if we can put this into a little historical context. So you ultimately decide to depart from Salomon to set up your own shop in 1989, correct?
Correct.
And then in 93, you begin accepting client assets to manage as well?
Well, we started to have some good results on Wall Street Week, and people mm-hmm. called, and the man was there, so we said, why not?
Okay. I completely understand. In fact, speaking of Wall Street Week, you were a panelist on the show for 14 years. In 99, Rukeyser inducted you into Wall Street Week Hall of Fame, calling you simply the world's number one stock picker. That's pretty high accolade.
Well, we had been lucky. We had an approach which worked very well, and we were willing to share that approach with the people who were on the show.
And somewhere in the middle of that, you did some global trading strategy with Deutsche Bank. What were the years of that?
That was probably about 92 to 95, where I was a consultant to them, and I worked with them on, the kind of work we were doing in the United States. We exported it, and we found it worked in foreign markets as well.
Oh, that sounds quite fascinating. All right, so we were talking earlier about what you describe yourself, not as a technical analyst, but really as a performing market analysis. address that. What is the difference between what technicians do and what someone who just studies markets does, and how does that manifest itself?
Well, I think one of the key words there, Barry, is study. Mm-hmm. One of my concerns about technical analysis is there really isn't too much in analysis. It's an awful lot of commentary, and it's driven by a lot of conclusions. Our approach has always been to try to understand what's happening and tell people the parameters, the metrics they should be aware of, and then let them make their own decisions. So instead of telling you to get from here to Greenwich on Route 95, we want to tell you there's three different roads, and one is the best 55% of the time, one is best 35% of the time, and the other is 15% of the time, and give you the various circumstances which that provides. And so we're not so much interested in giving predictions as we're giving history and some parameters.
So it's really more of a probability analysis than a forecasting process.
And it's a lot of history. It's surprising how little we know about the market and how much we forget, in part because every day we have so many inputs, we have so many ideas. Mm-hmm. But we find by keeping track of these, you can come up with some real guidance and real useful money-making information.
Interesting. So I want to take a quote. You gave an interview to this, I want to say, in 2006, to the Kirk Report, and then you also are a featured chapter. I actually think you're the first chapter in Heretics of Finance by Andrew Lowe. And I pulled this quote that you had said that just was astonishing. In the 1980s, and a little context, the bear market, Dow hits 1,000 in 1966, doesn't get over 1,000 on a permanent basis till 1982. And that started an 18-year bull market. But the quote, which I found astonishing, was in the 1980s, there were over 2,000 trading days. Only 11 of those days were the public net buyers of equity, 11 out of 2,000. And yet we constantly see, oh, here's what's going on with money flow. Here's what the public is doing. It really doesn't matter what the public is doing, does it?
Well, it matters in the sense that you should know. Mm-hmm. But if you think that you have to have A to have B, you often don't really know A.
Right.
And Barry, if I can correct you, and I apologize, the market did not hit 1,000 in 1966. The Dow did not hit 1,000 in 1966. The Dow did not hit 1,000 until 1972. In 1966, and I want to say December the 11th, the sum of the high of the 30 Dow stocks.
Of the day.
Was 1,005. But at no point during the day.
Was the Dow itself over 1,000?
Was the Dow over 1,000.
I'm going to have to go pull that data because that is always the quote for 1966. Actually, the way I used to say it was the Dow kissed 1,000 in 1966, didn't get over. But you're telling me, what was the high in 1966?
It was probably on that day, 995 and change.
Spitting distance, but not quite that.
Not quite.
So, in other words, lacking technology to see it in real time the way we do today.
That's right.
Some people added everything up. Oh, look, if you take the
highs. That's how the Dow count. That's what the Dow presented. The Dow's high every day, but that was how they did it.
Just the highest tick of each Dow stock.
Dow stock.
Not the highest tick at any given second. That's fascinating.
I had always hoped to find somebody who had a Polaroid of the Bunker-Ramo system that day.
Uh-huh.
But no one ever came forth.
No such luck. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Laszlo Barini of Barini Associates, where he explains why technical analysis is not all that.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. This week, I'm thrilled to have Laszlo Barini here. We were talking about the problem with technical analysis and pundits and forecasting. Let's get into that in a little more detail. And I want to start with a wonderful quote that you referenced from Peter Drucker, and it goes like this. Prussians lost World War I in part because not enough generals got killed. Would you explain that? I just love that quote.
Well, Peter Drucker was one of my professors in graduate school, and a wonderful, wonderful individual. And his point was that the generals in World War I were so far removed from the battlefield that by the time they got the intelligence and were able to relay instructions, there was too big a time lag. And one of the unfortunate trends of the last 10, 15 years is that managers and people in the market are getting away from the market. We don't have ticker tapes anymore, for just one example. And managers are now involved with all sorts of quantitative approaches. And the old managers that I grew up with, like John Neff, they wanted to know what was going on in the market. What was happening? What do you see? And those people wanted to talk to the trading desk as much as they wanted to talk to the strategists. What are the trends? Not necessarily what are your opinions or what do you think, but what are you hearing? You know, what are the people on the floor of exchange saying and things like that? And as Drucker said, if you're really far away from things, you're going to lose a lot in the interval.
So it's a function not just of timing, but also of details and facts. If you're not watching the actual battle take place, you're missing out on a lot of input.
Exactly. And I think that today we're all involved in all sorts of macro issues and have these long conversations about tapering and other issues. But those are like two or three steps away from the action. And I think that one of the things we try to do is help people a lot, not only what's going on, but what has happened. Is there a precedent for the kind of period we have? Is there some time in the past where we've seen this before? And it's amazing how helpful that can be and how many inefficiencies it's created that people can take advantage of.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your criticism of pundits and commentary and forecasts. One of the things I enjoy reading from you is something you had written, the negative case is always more articulate because it's based on what you can see right now. Explain that in a little more detail.
Well, the market, which everyone agrees with, is a forecasting mechanism. The market's always looking ahead, so people are telling me what's going on now. Well, the market's not concerned about what's going on. The market is looking around the corner. And if we go back to 2009, the problems and the issues were very acute and they were worthy of the large headlines. But meanwhile, we had already started to see that the selling had tapered off and there was some slight buying going on and the bad news, the market wasn't going down as much. And the market, again, it's always one step ahead of us. And so the positive arguments aren't as clear and they're not as in focus, while the negative is right in front of us and staring us in the face, and it's on page one and page three and on page one of the financial section. So you have to, if you're going to be successful in the market, you've got to have some faith.
So, and to put this into a little more context, in 2009, you came out fairly aggressively bullish early in the year. I think everybody... The few people who did that got a lot of pushback. How could you want to buy equities? Look how terrible all the news is. But really what you're saying is that news flow is already reflected in actions that have taken place. It's already in the stock price.
It's in the stock price and it's also in the stock action. I mean, one of my most memorable calls was telling people to buy Apple in 1997 on Wall Street Week.
And it was at $7.
About then, yeah. And it was interesting because if you went to sell Apple at that time, if you sold 1,000 shares of Apple at that time, you got the bid side of the market. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to sell 20,000 shares, you were able to sell at the offering side of the market because the buyers were of such magnitude and scope that they didn't want to show their hand for a mere 1,000 shares.
Right.
But if you had 20,000, then, come into my den into a trader. That tells me that, people are buying the stock.
And that plays right into what you really created, which was money flow analysis. And that's been the arguments against your money flow analysis have been, I think, pretty weak. Well, there's always a buyer and a seller. Yeah, but the money flow, and to define it for people who may not follow this, you look to see is in a given stock, let's take Apple, are more trades taking place on the bid or on the ask, that spread, and that reflects, are buyers more aggressive and paying up, or are sellers more aggressive and selling down to the bid.
And I think another parallel, which probably is more comfortable for the average person, is we've all heard stories about the apartment which went on the market for $785,000 and traded 3 hours later at $880,000. And you might say, well, there was only one buyer and one seller. Well, no, there's a lot of buyers.
There had to be a bunch of bidders driving the price above. Yeah. It's four or five bidders going through that process. Right. There's no doubt about that. So we're going to get to the dark pools and HFT later and what that might be doing to change this. But tell a little bit about how you developed Money Flow and how it's since been used by big institutions and other such firms.
Well, Money Flows is actually not my idea. It was sort of outlined in the famous Reminiscence of a Stock Operator. Mm-hmm. And back when I came into Wall Street, there were still people who would watch the tape. They would, in those days, I remember days when there were 8-10 million share trades, and you could literally watch 90% of the trades. And people would look and they could see the buying and selling. And there was a time when if you go to the floor of the stock exchange, you could feel the interest in the stock. You could feel when the market was starting to rally. And so what we did was we translated this into a computer program. And first we articulated block trades, where we were able to segregate all the block trades and show if they were up ticks or down ticks.
More than 10,000 shares.
More than 10,000 shares. And it was also at the time Barron's used to run every 25,000 share block in the weekend newspaper. And what we did was we listed all the 10,000 share trades, and we noted that something like Gulf Oil, for example, might ordinarily trade three blocks in a given week, but last week it traded seven blocks, five of which were done at a higher price. And one might have been done to last sale, and one might have been at a lower price, but it was basically 5-1 on the upside, which told a lot of traders, somebody's buying Gulf Oil.
We're speaking with Laszlo Borini, formerly of Salomon Brothers, now with Borini Associates. Coming up, we continue our conversation discussing technology failure and system failures and how that affects investors and the stock market.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz, and this week I'm speaking with Laszlo Borini, a Borini Associates, and effectively the inventor. You credit Lefebvre and you credit the earlier traders for identifying that, but you're really the person who took Money Flow and turned it into something that I can access on a Bloomberg terminal. True?
Well, I and the resources of Salomon Brothers.
Okay. So, but I mean, you were the driver of this. It wasn't, you know, this didn't just come out of left field. It's,
no,
hey,
it's,
we should be able to quantify this and put this on a terminal. Which leads me to something I read of yours that was quite fascinating. So on the one hand, technology is a really useful tool that allows us to see things in real time that we couldn't see in the old days. But on the other hand, occasionally technology fails us. And you had said something, I want to quote you from 2006. You had said, be very concerned about system failure. There are more breakdowns and failures than people realize. And this was long before the market crash, the credit markets froze up, or the flash crash came along. Talk a little bit about system failure.
Well, when we proposed all the new regulations and rule changes in late 1990s and before that, I was concerned because there was never any discussion about what are the impacts, mm-hmm. what are the repercussions. And my attitude was that if you take a piece of sausage and squeeze one end, something's going to happen at the other.
To say the least.
And I just didn't see anyone addressing that. And I'd also, at Salomon, been responsible for the global index, which caused me to visit markets all over the world. And I had visited the London Stock Exchange and explained to them that their idea of Big Bang in 1986 was not well thought out, and that there were some issues that they might give some reference to. And unfortunately, I was correct. And I saw that we were doing a lot of the same things in the United States without realizing that someone had already done this And one of the things that one of the senior people at the LSC said a year later said, if we could do it all over again, we would.
So in other words, the Big Bang turned out to be much more problematic than anyone anticipated. I know listeners are going to say, but isn't that true for anything we do? You never really can know the unintended consequences and repercussions of actions, especially you have the butterfly effect, you have wholesale changes, Reg NSD, all these major changes that we've had in the structure of the market. Do we really fully understand the impact of high-frequency trading and dark pools today?
No, I don't think we do, but I think that the point was that they should at least give themselves an out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, S&P for a while came out and they said, we'll do it for 30 days and
right.
We'll see what happens. And what they did was they were using only American Stock Exchange prices for some of their stocks.
Right.
And then they found out that some of those stocks don't trade the American Stock Exchange. But they had already started off and saying, we're only going to do it for 30 days, and then we'll see what happens. It didn't work, so they went back.
Right.
And I think that we got ourselves into a box by making these changes and saying, okay, this is it. And then we found out,
Maybe not so much. So fast forward to May of a few years ago, we have the flash crash. Do we still not fully understand what caused that? And why should anyone think there's not another one of those somewhere off in the future?
Yes.
I think they're both.
I've felt for a long time that the systemic failure exists. And I think it's not only just the failures. It's the things that happen in the marketplace today which are not beneficial to investors. The fact that you can take a simple trade. We had a situation, Barry, where Twitter trades 130 million shares a day.
Mm-hmm.
We had a situation where somebody sent us where they bought 400 shares. It took five transactions.
For 400 shares?
400 shares. Two of the transactions were 50 cents apart.
That's insane. You would think that would be liquid as hell.
You would think that you would do it with a snap of a finger.
Right.
And I think that because we are trading 100 billion shares, you know, we don't really process all these.
Right.
But we find that this happens too often.
I'm in the midst of a Twitter debate with Cliff Asness, who's of AQR, who called me a Luddite because I'm not a big fan of high-frequency trading. You know, the specialist system was corrupt, but it served a social purpose, and they were ready, willing, and able to make a market and obligated to. HFT traders have no such obligation. In theory, they're narrowing the spread. They're increasing liquidity until they decide they don't want to, and they can just flip the machines off anytime they want. Preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Laszlo Borini of Borini Associates, and we discuss why great investors are very much like great chefs when they go to market and pick their freshest ingredients.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. Today, I'm happy to be speaking with Laszlo Borini of Borini Associates. We were talking about system failure and how things go wrong. You've been doing this for quite a number of years. I'm really curious as to a couple of things that you've either written or talked about over the years. And again, I'm going to another quote of yours, and we briefly spoke about gurus and forecasts and predictions and how terrible they are. I thought this was really an insightful comment from you. Most people approach the market in a way I term the housewife's dinner process. She decides what she wants to serve and then goes shopping and fills up her basket with all the ingredients she needs. That's the opposite of the way the great chefs work. They go to market first. They see what's available, what's fresh, and based on that, they plan their menu. As someone once said, cooking is three-quarters shopping. Like the French chef, I let the market dictate what I should do, not my shopping list. I just find that to be a delightful metaphor. Address some of that, if you would.
Well, first of all, that's changed a little bit. I think it's now one-quarter foraging.
Right.
From what I read about the chefs. Basically, you know, one of the oldest and most used cliches is don't fight the tape.
Right.
And what we try to do is understand what is going on in the market. Mm-hmm. And a big ingredient in that is understanding the history. I think one of our proudest moments was at the beginning of 2009. We suggested that this, or a little bit into 2009, we suggested this was be a long, protracted experience. Why? Because the financial stocks led the market. Mm-hmm. When the financial stocks lead bull markets, those are the really durable, sustainable, protracted bull markets. And the financial stocks gained 100% in the first 6 to 8 weeks. So that told us right then and there.
Off of the 09 lows.
Off the 09 low. And that suggested to us that the market was telling us that, you know, fasten your seatbelt because it's going to be a long ride.
And here it is almost 5 years. It is five years later.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's June of 2014. So I don't get the sense you're necessarily in the secular bull market camp. There are guys like Jeff Sout of Raymond James and Ralph Acampora, a well-known technician, who say, hey, we're in another long market cycle like 82 to 2000 or 66 to 82 that could go for 10, 15 years. Do you think the market is suggesting as much?
I think the smart, we have defined market in four segments, mm-hmm. and we are now in the exuberance segment.
So what are the four? What are those four segments?
First, you start off with reluctance,
mm-hmm.
and then you have consolidation, acceptance,
mm-hmm.
then you have consolidation, and then you have last one in the pool.
Right, has to pay pick up the check.
And, you know, we still really haven't seen signs of that.
So we haven't hit. Really? So let's see. We had the initial stage was that first move off
that
the
reluctance.
Lows. Right? And everybody, by the way, the most hated rally in market history. Everybody, we were 20% off the lows. And, oh, this has gone too far, too fast already. And the market kept going. Then last year we had a boom, 2013, up almost 30% on the S&P. And then add dividends and you're over 30%. This year, we're more or less flat. Would you consider this the consolidation phase?
No, this is really an exuberance. We're in the exuberant phase.
Even though markets essentially going sideways.
Yeah, because we've passed consolidation. But really, we still haven't got that real takeoff period. We haven't got that point where we have magazine covers.
Right.
We haven't seen, we've had 14 new highs in the S&P.
Never front page story.
Never front page story.
It's almost buried.
It's not even a front page business page story.
Right. So how can we be exuberant if it's not trumpeted? You know, I recall, I came about in the 90s, and I remember 99 and 2000 vividly, and you just had a relentless stream of magazine covers, and the new thing was the book by Michael Lewis, which came out in the early 2000s about that era, and it was just earnings didn't matter. It was about clicks and eyeballs and a new paradigm, and it was trumpeted on the front of every publication. I don't really feel that same level of exuberance yet.
No, but I think it's going to happen. I think you're still going to, historically, it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is the press has become a little bit marginalized and a little bit more politically oriented than they might have been 20, 30 years ago. But I still think that the history tells us we're going to have...
I thought you were going to say, well, they've learned their lesson, but you're not saying that at all.
No, I still think that, you know, that you're still going to have that time where the public is going to come back and the barista is going to ask you what you're buying. And,
right.
And so we're still hanging in there.
How long could that exuberant phase last?
I don't know.
Like historically, what is it?
Well, historically, I think we probably should be... Yes, maybe another 12 months, but again, these are very flexible parameters.
And could be 3 months, could be 2 years. Yeah. There's no.
I mean, already it's different in the fact that the public hasn't come in by this point after what we've gone through. So no, I wouldn't put any. I just see, leave the door open.
Right.
Don't take anything off the table.
So this can continue running for the foreseeable future.
Yes.
The exuberance phase isn't. Hey, we have a high tick in sentiment. Everybody out of the pool. Instead, what I'm hearing from you is we have a high tick in sentiment, and based on history, this could go another year as mom and pop finally come back to the market late as they typically do.
Yeah, and it's some of these bonds mature and people look around. So I'm just saying leave the door open and let the good times roll.
Let the good times roll. So let's talk a little bit about changes you've seen in the last 5 or 6 minutes we have. You've seen a lot of changes in the world of investing over the course of your career. What's different today? And again, I have to go back to a quote from yours. We've gone from long-term to fiduciary investing to performance investing and now tradings. Huge dislocations have resulted, and I don't think many people understand them. Is that a reflection of the changes you've seen in the decades you've been working on Wall Street?
Yes, it's also a function of technology.
Mm-hmm.
The world has changed. It's become incredibly more complex and more difficult. I wouldn't overemphasize the trading because I still think we make our big money in investing.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing that we focus a lot on, we tell our clients a lot on today, is accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Don't listen to anybody where you don't have an economic accountability.
In other words, someone goes on TV and says, buy this, sell that.
Don't listen to them because there's nothing you can't punish them. You know, You can't fire them. We have a newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, and it's surprisingly infrequently, we'll have somebody who's not happy. We say, you know, we'll give you your money back.
Right.
You know, cancel your subscription. We don't want to think that we're not providing value.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, we find out that the reason they're not doing well is they didn't listen. I didn't like that stock. Well,
right.
You know.
I have a friend who's an attorney in California who used to describe his job as giving really good advice that gets ignored. And the quote, the follow-up to that is, well, how does anyone make a living doing that? He goes, the cleanup is really expensive. And in finance, there's a lot of that. You have a parade of people, wholly unaccountable. I guess you can flick the channel or cancel the subscription, but nobody's accountable on Twitter. Nobody's accountable in print. There really isn't a lot of people coming forward and saying, hey, I was wrong about this. Sorry about that. Here's where I went wrong. Here's my miscalculation. You don't see much of that. So your advice is to ignore the pundits, think for yourself.
Or listen to what they have to say and follow up on it.
Put it into context.
Do a little work. You know, unfortunately, Barry, I've been doing this for almost 40 years. I'm working harder now than I ever did before.
That's amazing.
There's more to do. There's more. You know, 40 years ago, FTSE was referred to a date with somebody.
Right.
You know, we didn't know about the Nikkei. There was no Saturday Wall Street Journal.
That's right.
You know, and if you pick up a Barron's from 40 years ago, the ads were all for newsletters and services, not funds.
And those newsletters pretty much seem to have been, are more or less fading away, aren't they?
I really question where you get some sort of a newsletter survey.
Mark Holbert does that. He reviews the long-running surveys to see how they've done. Some are pretty okay. Most, you know, the takeaway is always, if you really have the secret sauce, raise a little money and trade it yourself. Why would you give away a truly magic formula unless it's simply a tool to help other people make better decisions? And you actually have done that. Your money flow is essentially that tool. So to the investors listening out there in the last minute we have, what would you suggest they focus their efforts on if they're not a day trader, if they're longer term investors?
Again, be very careful about your inputs. To me, too many individuals look at our world as a salad bar, and they take a lot of different ingredients and they try to make their own salad. I say, have a discipline. If you're going to listen to me, listen only to me and one other person or whatever, and work at it. You know, it's not just something you can do on a casual basis. It is work. And I'm always surprised that people who spend a lifetime to get $1 million portfolio think they can do it for an hour a week
and that's
and have
it.
The same results.
Thank you, Laszlo, for spending so much time with us. If you'd like to hear more of our interview with Laszlo Borini, check out our podcast extras on Bloomberg.com. My daily column appears on BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz or see my daily blog at Ritholtz.com. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. This concludes the broadcast portion of our interview. Coming up with our guest, the Radio Podcast Extra. I'm here sitting with Laszlo Borini, who was an elf on Rukeyser's show. I don't know if you heard the rumor, but someone's actually trying to bring that show back.
I've heard, yeah.
I believe it's the guy who runs the SALT conference is bringing that back.
That's right.
Scaramucci, Anthony Scaramucci, nice guy. I think he bought all the archives, and he's going to bring the show back. I wonder if the public has the patience for that. You know, it was, I watched it, I don't want to say quite as a kid, but I watched it when I was younger, and it was known for just being not, you know, compare and contrast with the fast cuts and MTV and that sort of stuff. It moved at a very, let's call it deliberate pace, which is very different than what you get today. Swooping sound effects and flashy graphics. He was just really basic, down to earth. Here's the straight dope. Let me bring someone in to talk to you about what happened this week. There was no bells and whistles. It was just all meat, all steak, no sizzle. What was it like being on that show at the time? That's really pre-financial television.
Well, say one little story. Somebody told me when I got on the show, just remember one thing. Your job, you're a spear catcher.
A spear catcher, okay.
Lou was the man. It was Lou's show, and you were just part of the background and decoration.
That's nice. So, but you became an elf, and you did the show for 14 years, right?
Yeah, it was a long time, yeah.
There was a story that in 97, 98, some of the elves had become a little too bearish, and he cut a few people loose. Any truth to that?
There was some people who I thought forgot what they were there for.
Right.
And I think Lou's knew what people wanted to hear. He wanted to calm people down and tell them the world was not going to come to an end, and that we didn't really need to have the mega bears.
Right.
Especially when they were theoretical.
Well, and that goes back to what you said earlier, that the negative case always sounds so persuasive because it's what's right in front of you. It's really easy to get sucked into that. You know, you talk about him, Rukeyser, calming people down. I think it was the 25th anniversary of the 87 crash, I dug up a YouTube copy of Rukeyser's show and posted it on the blog. And he comes out and he couldn't be calmer. I don't know if he's tossing back scotches before the show.
He wasn't.
But he came out and rock steady. Hey, market really got shellacked this week. Here's why you shouldn't really sweat it too much. It was really quite fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about Apple, because you had mentioned the $7 call in 97 or 98, and it subsequently ran up to 300 split adjusted or 150 split adjusted. So that turned out to be really a well-timed call. I'm curious as to the pushback at the time.
The pushback was especially from hedge funds.
Who were short?
Who were short, and they were not going to cover. Mm-hmm. And about a year and a half later, one hedge fund gave us, in our annual business conversation, like double or triple our allocation.
Uh-huh.
And I thanked him profusely because it's a lot of money. And he said, I bought Apple.
Because of you.
He said, I was short, but after talking to you and knowing what you do and how you do it, I went long.
And that was a good trade.
That was a very good trade for me.
So around that same time, a friend was the head of the bond department at a fairly large firm that's no longer here, and I'll spare them the indignity of mentioning their name, and he brought me in for an interview. And like you, I was bullish on Apple. Microsoft deal, all this stuff. Hey, it looked like they got a lifeline. There was a narrative as to why Apple wasn't going under. And they asked me for this interview, prepare a bullish case and a bearish case for two stocks. So I said to my buddy, what are the two biggest positions in the firm? Well, they're long Conseco and they're short Apple. Oh, well, I have a bullish case for Apple and Conseco, which had gone straight up. had just rolled over. The money flow is terrible. The trend had been broken. Like, every indicator you could possibly look said Conseco is a disaster.
And the chairman had a big house.
And a huge house. So I make this presentation, and the guy, the CEO of the company, says, you're 100% wrong. Here's why. I go, let me stop you. I know this is an interview. I don't have a position in either of these stocks. I'm completely objective. Could go up, down. I don't care. These are the two biggest positions in your firm. You have to have them right or you have big problems. And it was, he's like, doesn't matter. We're definitely right. Okay. And subsequently, they're gone. You know, you can only be so wrong on some. It's okay to be a little wrong. You can't be wildly wrong and double down. So they were short Apple, single digits, 20, 30, 40. At $50, I remember calling my buddy and saying, hey, you guys covering Apple yet? And his answer was, I don't know if they're covering Apple, but I'm looking for a new job. So, and he was in the bond desk. He just knew, he saw the trouble coming. It was amazing. There are so many great Apple stories out there. I can't begin to tell you from 2001, 2002, when that newfangled iPod came out. I was a big Apple fan. I got my hands on one of the first ones. I remember showing it to people and telling people about it. And the answer was pretty much, forget Apple. They're toast. They're going out of business. They had a shot when Jobs came back. That was it. The new Sony Walkman isn't going to save them. Oh, okay, if you say so. So that's fascinating. And what else stands out as one of those trades where everybody looks at you like you have two heads?
I think 1995 was one. Going into 1995, we had just had the Mexican crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the long bond was at 7.625.
Wow.
And people were expecting 9-10%. My former colleague, Henry Kaufman, was saying 10%. And in one of those classic cases, we saw tremendous buying in GTE.
Mm-hmm.
GTE in the fourth quarter of 94 went from 30 to 30, but there was $150 million worth of net buying.
From 30?
To 30.
So it went nowhere.
Nowhere. But there was $150 million worth of net buying. So people were very quietly
accumulating.
They were moving the stock, which is...
means there's a lot of stock for sale.
We know it means smart buyer.
Okay.
Okay, very, you know, it's like a good poker player.
Right.
You know, he's drawing you in without...
but someone's out there selling it.
Yeah, but he's very quietly. What's happening is he's buying 10,000 shares up an eighth,
mm-hmm.
and then selling 100 shares down an eighth.
Gotcha.
Okay,
so you could do that back then. I don't know if you could get away with that
anymore. Well, you can be more easily.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But so what? So I went on, I was on the year-end show that year too, and Lou said, what do you think for 1995? And the consensus on the street was, you know, with long bond going at 10%, that we were looking at another 15-20% S&P down.
Uh-huh. That's a big move.
And I said the market's going up 10-15%. And the market opened at the low that year. And
that was the low tick of the year, January 2.
And it just kept going all year. And
what happened with GTE?
GTE, I got 50% total return GTE that year.
For 1 year?
1 year.
Not too
shabby. Telephone company.
Right. Well, that's supposed to be safe and boring and not so much anymore.
It wasn't none of the above.
So you worked with guys like Rukeyser. Who were some of your early mentors? Who helped form your philosophy of investing?
Well, a lot of it really comes not from business. I mean, mm-hmm. like Peter Drucker taught me a lot about, and again, you know, one of Drucker's, he's noted for asking the stupid question, you know, what business are we in?
Mm-hmm.
And what is your real job and who are your real customers? And one of the things that I remember when I was a young trader and all these smart guys on Wall Street were saying things, I asked myself the Peter Drucker question of how does he know?
Right.
And then when I started to push back, I found he doesn't know.
But he sounds good.
He sounds good.
Right.
You know, and it opened, I realized the opportunity I had not to be the smartest trader, not to be the biggest trader, but to be the most knowledgeable. So I started to read a lot more. And quite frankly, a lot of what I read has nothing to do with the markets. It's things like McLuhan,
mm-hmm.
and even the New York Times has so many interesting articles, which are just not even related to the market.
Right.
And I learned to push back and actually become a little bit skeptical as a result of some of Drucker's things. And it's just amazing how many doors have opened to us and ideas. So when people say things, mm-hmm. you know, we sit there and we say, what's wrong with this picture? I mean, one of my big concerns today, and I'm apparently the only one who has it, is that the five-year capital-adjusted price-earnings ratio is totally overblown.
Meaning in what way?
It's not an indicator. And if you go,
well, is PE really an indicator for most of the time?
It isn't. But this time, everyone says that when it gets to 25 times,
right,
that 5 years hence, you're on average down 12%.
Right.
Wrong. Wrong. If you just sit down and do the
numbers. Look at the math. It's not true.
Not even close.
Do you track Shiller's 10-year CAPE?
That's what I'm talking about.
So the 10-year CAPE.
10-year, 5-year, doesn't matter.
So we looked at the same thing because last fall, Merrill Lynch's quant team did a study on valuation. And they said, we picked the 15 most commonly used valuation metrics. And it's everything from a simple forward four-quarter PE to the 10-year Shiller CAPE. And the bulk of the 14 of the 15 were the markets were fair value, a little under, a little over. But the meat of it was things were reasonable. Shiller CAPE was order of magnitude too expensive. So we looked at that and said, why are guys who never look at valuation or PE banging the drum on Shiller CAPE other than it supports, you know, their shopping. It supports their pre-existing dinner plans. So, hey, we're bearish, so we're going to pick the most bearish. And, you know, you could pick one and ignore the other 16. So based on that, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I'm not sure if I'm going to get the numbers exactly right. I think since 1998, the Shiller 10-year CAPE has been expensive or above its median something like 80% of the time. So in other words, you're not supposed to be in stocks four out of the five times. It has zero value as a timing indicator for investors.
And it's just plain wrong.
Just plain wrong.
The numbers that people throw out and say, this is the result.
Right.
And you know, I have nothing against Dr. Shiller.
I love the guy. His work is great. Yeah, and this is, he would tell you, this is just a way to give you a little context, to use it as a buy and sell signal.
But if you look, I mean, we look at some of the things he wrote in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing he's not a market strategist.
So let's talk about some hedge fund managers and some strategists. We, every year, we see this big Ira Sohn conference where the smartest, greatest hedge fund managers come out and they give you their very best stock pick. You've been tracking this stuff, haven't you?
Well, you know that we do, just as a matter of course, and we track a lot of things.
Right.
And I never really hold one. You know, that does nothing tough. Right. To make one thing.
But now you have a collection of a dozen separate picks.
Well, one of the things that you know, we've done a lot of research, and I pride myself on the fact that we probably spend as much time on research as we do in marketing, and. One of the things we learned recently, last year when I wrote a book, and it probably took me too long to learn it, the market has a forecasting time frame of 3 to 6 months.
That's all.
That's all.
Can't look out a year, can't look out 5 years, can't look out 10 years.
Okay, that was what we got from money flows. Because if you look at the money flows and you look, okay, how long was it before this came to fruition? Invariably, it's 3 to 6 months.
Right.
So anybody's going on beyond 6 months is going into the realm of the unknown and unknowable.
That's what Laxman Athashan says about the economic cycle. Same basic concepts. You could look 3 to 6 months out. The market often gives you that much of an economic forecast. But a year out, there are so many different things that are going to happen. You know, stop and think about Keene's beauty contest. Wait, you want me to forecast this? What people are going to be feeling about the market a year hence? Stop and think about how much stuff is going to happen between now. How can anybody forecast what people a year from now will be forecasting with how they spend their dollar?
Yeah. So that's why I don't hold 1 year forecast against anybody.
It's
marketing.
It's marketing. It's not actually.
Yeah, you know, Joe Granville says if you want to make a name in this business, you know, do some outrageous forecasts.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he did.
Finally. But if you're right, you'll be a hero. If you're wrong, well, people will forget it.
So on that exact note, it's so funny you mentioned that. So I was very aware of the fact that the forecast, and look, full disclosure, I've made some forecasts in my day, not because I wanted to, but every now and then you're on some show or you're doing something and they press you for it. I've said to Tom Keene, I don't know. And people look at you, you know, where's the market going to be in a year? I don't know. But I started this whenever I would see an especially ridiculous forecast. I would do one of two things. Either I would save the person's link and commentary and use Outlook and diary it for 5 years. Just forget about it. Mm-hmm. Or there's a service called followupthen.com. It's an email service. And you, for the address, you just put a date at followupthen.com. So something came up today. So I've been pretty bearish on gold for a few years. I wrote something about it this week. And somebody who I think is kind of a pain in the neck said, oh, great, Ritholtz just bottom-ticked gold. Not that, you know, I missed 700 down points, but I bottom-ticked gold because I happened to mention it the other day. And so what I did was I sent an email to November 5th at followupthen.com with the link. And on November 5th, they'll automatically shoot me back an email. So you forget about all these things that come back. And I'm either going to say to this person, hey, you were right. It looks like I bottom-ticked gold after being right for 600 points. Or, by the way, anytime you want to take the other side of my trade, because you're a bum and everything you say is wrong, I'm happy to, let's skip the exchange and you and I will do 10,000 shares mano a mano. How do you feel about that? But it's that exact concept of what you mentioned earlier of accountability, of holding people responsible. If you can't fire them for just blathering in public, at least you can point out, hey, you said this 6 months ago or a year ago or 5 years ago. You know, we did something not too long ago with the guys forecasting hyperinflation in 2010 based on QE. So I just diaried for a few years and it popped up. Nobody remembered. And then suddenly when that pops up, now everybody remembers, oh, you guys said hyperinflation. There's no hyperinflation. You said the dollar was going to collapse. Hey, it's at multi-year highs relative to the yen and the euro. So why, you were wrong then. Was your process wrong? What was wrong with that? And why should anybody listen to you in the future? So let's talk a little bit about, you said Drucker was a mentor. A lot of great investors whose work I follow all say the same thing about reading. That there's a lot of noise in the world, and you've talked about noise, but you're better off picking up the great books from history and learning about what was rather than the superficial frivolity today.
Just anything. I mean, I read a book, an excerpt from about doctors, mm-hmm. what makes good doctors. And the point was, it was a magazine article, and the point was that they spent too much time on procedures and tests and not enough time with talking to the client.
Right.
They find out that the best source of information about a client's health is the client.
Right. The actual patient, the actual patient can give you more information than...
And again, it's like listening to the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
get on the front lines. Don't just stand, shoot, don't be a backseat driver.
Yeah, then, you know, don't look at some quantitative screen or some charts or whatever, you know.
Exclusively. You have to be in the mix.
In the mix. So it's just a whole range of things I just find tangentially to the market, which really do help.
So if we're going to break this down to a couple of lists as to advice you would give, if you're an active trader, make sure you're actually involved in watching, not just looking from a distance. With all the technology today, you don't physically have to be anywhere near an exchange. You could be right in the market from anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world.
Although I do miss the trading room.
Right. So,
you know, at Salomon, we build a new trading floor.
Uh-huh.
And within a month, we had to reconfigure it because we had a tape that was only... I know, 12, 15 feet long.
You needed a longer tape.
We needed a longer tape.
So when I was at Maxim Group, which was the merger of Herzog and Investec, my office was right off the training room. And I used to jokingly say, I don't need a Bloomberg terminal. I could tell you what the market's doing just by listening to that. And there was an energy on a trading floor that just doesn't exist anywhere in the world. It's electrifying, and whether good or bad, I mean, electrifying could be negative as well, but there was something about stepping out of my office into that din that was really quite amazing. Now, where you are up in Connecticut, I got to think it's a little quieter.
It's boring.
Is it boring?
Yeah.
But shouldn't good investing be boring? I mean, are too many people looking for, you know, looking for a vein, looking for a thrill?
I think that also has to do something with age.
There's a little bit of that, no doubt. But, I mean, if you want excitement, take $1,000, go to Vegas, or these days take $10,000, go to Vegas, have a good time. But shouldn't what people are trying to get out of the markets be, you know, long-term and boring, and the thrill should come elsewhere? Or is that incorrect? What do you think about that?
It should have its cycles. It should have, you know, the ups, and there should be days of excitement and days. And I'm not concerned the last several weeks where everyone is talking about how quiet things are.
This has been a really low volume rally also, hasn't it?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't make a difference.
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
Because volume doesn't matter.
So I always was taught, so here's one of the things that you can push back. Hey, volume is a sign of institutional enthusiasm. That was the cliche that would come my way.
One of my jobs at Salomon Brothers was to help the trading desk make money.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to formulate trading rules. And we looked for years, and have continued to look for years, at volume triggers.
Uh-huh.
When is volume good or bad? And we actually write papers which are sort of quasi-academic.
Right.
We will take a subject and—
Topical study 43, volume.
And so we looked at it, okay, well, if volume goes up 10% over a 20-day period, what does the market tend to do? Well, sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down.
Oh. So in other words, nothing.
So if volume goes down 20% or whatever, and it just comes out, it's so much of it is random.
So— It's just noise, and it's not validated by the data.
Exactly.
So let me ask you, what is validated by the data? What have you found are the things that matter most to driving equities?
Well, one of the things that we like about this market is resilience. We like the fact that you come in and the news isn't good and China is down for the whatever.
Ukraine and—
And whatever, and the futures are down 5 points. And so, you know, you're not feeling real good. And at 10:30, the market starts to get some traction. And like this, I don't know where we are now, but you know, when I left, we were up 10 points.
Right. That's about where we are right now at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on an early June day.
And the critical issue, I think, the thing that we watch more than anything else is sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the measures of sentiment that people look at generally are not useful.
So AAII, bull bear service,
sentiment. AAII is a random sampling of people who pick up the phone.
Right. But isn't that true of all surveys?
No.
Okay. So distinguish between that and another
Gallup survey or those surveys. Those are statistically valid.
Okay.
Okay, because they have pools and whatever.
So Gallup today just put out a survey, or maybe it was yesterday, hiring intentions of mid and small companies, highest level in 2 years.
That's a valid survey done scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
AAII is whoever picks up the phone that week.
Okay.
We did an interesting graph and sent it to you sometime where we took the AAII results and flipped them upside down.
Okay.
And then we showed them people which is which.
No answer.
Duh.
They couldn't tell.
And if AI had any validity, there should be some correlation between good weeks and next week.
And there is none. So what sentiment data do you find has some correlation?
The newspapers.
The news in general, front pages.
The media. We go through a lot of media, and every day we clip and save the major news stories.
Wow.
In the press, it comes off of Bloomberg, all sorts of magazines.
Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Barron's.
There's a whole lot of it. I go to the barbers, I go get my hair cut half hour early, so I go to the magazines.
Right.
And we have this clipping, we call it anecdotal clippings. Mm-hmm. We have it going back to 1962.
Of all the major news stories that day.
All the major news stories, right?
And so what do you find?
What we find is the real sentiment. right? And that, and to give you one example, again, which was very profitable, as we surveyed what technicians were saying from the 09 bottom on.
Right.
The initial reaction to 09 was that this really wasn't a rally because we didn't have the correct setup for a market bottom, whatever that meant. And then we go on, and it's not really a good rally because there's no volume. And then we go into later stages of 09, and the technicians are telling us, well, we're due for a correction, and so on and so forth. So the technicians didn't like the rally until April 26, 2010.
April 26, 2010, okay.
Lead story, Monday morning, front financial page, technicians embrace the rally. We're up 80%, mm-hmm. and now it's okay to go in the water.
So what does that actually mean? How do you trade on that or invest on that?
You get out.
On that?
Yes.
But that was a huge percentage ago. That's 2000 and...
Wait, the market goes down 15%.
Right.
In the next 6 weeks. Okay.
So you avoid that pullback. And then what's the signal to get back in?
Absolute bottom. We got to 10,000, July 4th weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The longest story the New York Times has had about the bull market the entire 5 years,
right,
is uh-oh.
Here we go. I remember that story.
Bear market. Barron says, beware the bear.
Mm-hmm.
There's a journal story. We have an iron cross on the S&P.
Right.
And the market was a 500.
The death cross.
Death cross.
I love these names. The Hindenburg Omen, the death cross.
Market goes up 500 points that week. It's never looked back.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these indicators, which you've looked at the data. So the golden cross, where the 50 crosses the 200-day to the upside, or the death cross, where it crosses to the downside. What's the significance of this?
We're actually working on a piece, and I may write it tomorrow or I may write it Monday, where we've tracked all these headlines. Okay, now, I'm assuming the guy who wrote the headlines has done his work.
Right.
Okay, so
it's usually an editor, not the guy who writes
whatever.
The column.
Okay, so four stocks. What we found is that the golden crosses, they're up about, let's just say a number, 15%.
Right.
Behind the market, somewhat behind the market, okay? The death iron crosses... Guess what? They're about 15% too.
About the same.
Yeah.
So that's not exactly the sort of thing. But what about the Fed? QE is distorting everything. That's why everything is gone up. That's why none of our indicators have worked.
Then why use
it's
them?
All the Fed.
Then why
use them? Yeah. That's a good answer. I mean, that excuse has always been astonishing to me that... Well, nothing works because the Fed is intervening in the Treasury markets and their liquidity injection is completely disrupting everything. And that's why, you know, I always find it fascinating. The Fed does all these great things, but they couldn't stop a 57% crash. So they get credit for the move up, but hey, I thought they were in charge of this. You know, the plunge protection team, not very good at their job, apparently, because they didn't stop the plunge from happening. And yet they have the power to keep the market levitating.
But this to me is the first thing I advise people going into business. It was fascinating. And it's so interesting to look at this after a year, 5 years later, it's priceless.
So I give a presentation called Your Brain on Stocks. And I talk about headlines in the paper. And one of the headlines that I bet you have it saved was on October 15th. 2007, it was 4 days off the market high, October 11, and it was an anniversary. It was the 20-year anniversary of the 87 crash, and it was in the Wall Street Journal, and it says words to the effect of why crashes like 87 are going to be a thing of the past. You know, despite the housing rollover, an 87-like crash is highly unlikely. And I look at that as suggesting you can only get that sort of commentary after you've had a nice bull market, because the thought of a crash is almost unthinkable.
Yeah.
And then the flip side of it is the same paper a few years later after the flash crash, echoes of 87. Well, wait, didn't you just tell me that 87 is going to be a thing of the past. But by the time we had the 2010 flash crash, you've just suffered a 57% crash in the S&P, and everybody feels burned. Despite the move off the lows, people are still fixated on that sort of crash.
But that's our secret sauce.
And do you make this available online, or is this
only
in hard copies?
Only in hard copies. And basically what we do is then we draw charts like this, whereby we put it all together.
And I'll take some of this and scan it and put it on online.
So this, for example, is what the technicians were saying last year.
Last year. Oh, so you basically, here's a chart of the market going, the S&P going from about 1450 to about 1800. Buy pullbacks, see average choice, rise above 1457 would be bearish. I've always wondered, how is a rising market bearish? That always cracked me up. We did something similar to this year. We looked at, we were amazing how many people were saying, market's at a new high, this is very dangerous. So we went back for about 40 years and looked at maybe 60 years, what happens when markets make new highs? And it turns out that you get new highs in a bull market. In a bear market, you really don't get that many new highs because you're so far off of the previous high. So whether it was merely a correlation without causation or actually meant something, you get many more new highs in a bull market, which seems to intuitively make sense. And last year we had something like 28 or 38 new highs, and each one there would be an article, oh, new high is bearish. That was, you know, hundreds of points away. So I see you have a lot of the same things on this. S&P to drop 6 to 9% due to key reversal day. That's probably something I wrote. I'm going to embarrass myself with. S&P 500 long-term target. U.S. stocks suffer a deeper pullback in March on MACD loss of momentum. That really didn't come to pass. That pullback in March lasted 10 days, and then we were back off to the races. So you guys correlate the major technical articles, go short S&P 500 and long Apple on 128.13. How did that trade work out? Not too well, huh?
Well, never seen too many instances where someone's 200% wrong.
So in other words, they got them both exactly wrong. Speaking of Apple, doing much better these days.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the things you look at in an environment like this, despite the Fed influence, despite, you know, an economy that's on the brink of collapsing back into recession. I read constantly. We're about to don't pay attention to the winter. Someone actually emailed me yesterday. So we were talking about GDP, and again, not a lot of correlation to what markets do. But listen, I've mocked the retailers for blaming winter for poor sales. Who could have expected in Michigan in January the weather was going to be bad? Go figure. But to be fair, this was the worst winter, at least in the Northeast, although we had snow on the ground in 49 of 50 states on one day, something that doesn't happen very often. This was really a terrible winter. And so I was willing to say, all right, a lot of GDP data is going to get pushed forward to the second quarter. Let's at least wait and see. And so when that came out, hey, you had a negative 1% print for Q1, but hey, all the data seems to be improving a lot in Q2. Someone actually said to me, oh, so you make your investment decisions based on weather forecasts? No, not weather forecasts. We just saw this happen. This is history. This was the worst winter in half a century. Of course the housing data is going to be off, and of course the retail data is going to be off. Who's going out to look at cars when they're buried in 2 feet of snow? You're not going to buy a car. But apparently that's excuse making. So now we're seeing Q2 data come back. How much weight do you put on, you know, recent economic data? Is that important, or is the sentiment reaction more important than the data itself?
The market's not worried.
Doesn't care.
The market doesn't care. Last year, millions of words were written about tapering rates, housing. Whatever.
Tapering? We forgot all about tapering.
I had one simple response to all the questions.
Mm-hmm.
NVR.
NVR.
NVR is a home builder mortgage lender in Washington. Mm-hmm. It's an $1,100 price tag on the stock.
Wow.
So there's no finagling or high frequency or whatever.
Right.
Just supply and demand. The stock, it hits new all-time highs on a regular basis. If you have a home builder who's hitting new all-time highs, I'm not going to worry about housing.
Right.
It's going to give me an insight into interest rates.
Is that your canary in the coal mine? NVR. So if we watch that roll over.
If we watch it roll over, then I get a little bit nervous.
Right.
It's not rolling over.
It's not. It could be specific to that company anyway, or it could be indicia of something
people
bigger.
People worry about housing and say, go short NVR.
And the answer is they'll carry you out.
Yeah.
So what else do you look at? So a lot of this stuff is anecdotal, but you really try and quantify this. You try and objectively reduce this to numbers.
Yeah. Again, in addition to NVR, like a Whirlpool, Sherwin-Williams.
Whirlpool doubled last year, right? Yeah. Had a huge year.
Sherwin-Williams, another big move. There's no problem in housing.
Now, does that mean people aren't selling houses and just repainting, or
who knows? I don't know. And I don't care.
If Sherwin-Williams does, so you could say you correlate Sherwin-Williams to the broader economy and the stock market, positive correlation, leading indicator, how do you describe it?
Yeah, all of the above.
All of the above.
You know,
and the data supports this.
The market's, it seems to be, the market's up.
Sherwin-Williams up, the market's up, that's
again,
a good thing.
And again, here's where history comes in helpful. If you go back to the 1982, October the 5th, 1982,
mm-hmm.
right, we've just started a rally in the stock market. There's a very long story in Sunday New York Times about the economy, which is tanking.
Mm-hmm.
The economy is tanking. Unemployment is getting near 10%. Mm-hmm. Auto sales are down. We have a new president. Unemployment, yada, 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 right? And what in the world is the stock market doing? Right?
We had a new president, though, for over a year already by that time. Election is in 80, and he's sworn in 81.
And so in 1983, GNP is up 7%.
Wow.
1984, it's up 7%. Again, it's the difference between what the market's looking at and what you're looking at.
So you look at what's in front of your face. That's the inflation debate. I mentioned the other day that inflation is fairly modest. How could you say that? Look at the price of gasoline. Yeah, I see it. It's in 6 feet tall letters on every street corner. But that's not the only metric of inflation. You have to look at a lot of. Mm-hmm. Well, what about rent? Wait, aren't you the guy who is screaming that house prices are going up when rents were plummeting? I don't know which side of this to look at. Or do you just cherry pick whatever supports your position? So the market looks at all these things, makes an assessment based on all these inputs, and everything else, the front page stuff, it's mostly noise. What concerns you? What makes you wary of the future?
I continue to be concerned about the trading structure,
mm-hmm.
about the fact that we see keep pushing the kicking can down the road. Michael Lewis, Michael and I are old friends. I'm not sure that his wording is the rig, but there's still
there are problems.
There's problems. And I think that when I can't buy 500 shares of Twitter in a heartbeat, then
right.
Something's
off there.
And we still, because I am so close to trading, we still see too many things that are egregious. As far as beyond that, there's nothing that concerns me that I can forecast. Mm-hmm. I am concerned about Ukraine. I am concerned about.
Is Ukraine really going to impact?
Well, whether it's Ukraine or Thailand or whatever, these are not issues that are in my scope of.
Geopolitics impact the stock market very much?
Not as much as you. It causes a reflex.
Mm-hmm.
And
but really, since Ukraine broke out,
no, it hasn't.
Nothing's
even
happened.
When we had the Gorbachev kerfuffle in the mm-hmm. 90s, and that was over in a week or two.
Right.
The market, the market has a great ability to adapt and adjust.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing that really concerns me because I don't see anything in the market I don't see.
What about inflation?
Inflation doesn't concern me because, again, I see the stocks that should be affected.
Or not.
We could have inflation, but what the market is saying, it's I got it covered. In other words,
right.
It's not going to give me runaway.
And rates just seem to want to go lower and lower.
Yeah.
If really inflation was a big threat, should the 10-year be at 2.4, 2.5? Those are amazing numbers. By the way, you talked earlier about consensus. The beginning of the year, beginning of 2014, a survey by Bloomberg, 73 out of 73 economists were forecasting higher rates. Some even as high as 4.5%, 5%. And here we are. It's done nothing but go the other direction.
Same thing in 95. 95 is only one economist is looking for under 6%. And we did not go over 9% or 10%. We end up at 5.75%.
That's amazing. So the crowd, whether it's mom and pop or economists or analysts, frequently when there's consensus, that consensus is wrong. That's I'm trying to remember whose rules that Rosenberg loves to quote. When the crowd thinks one thing is going to happen, when everybody thinks one thing is going to happen, it's invariably something else. Yeah. So no worries about inflation. Rates aren't going higher. Geopolitics. What about earnings? I keep having people tell me, you know, earnings are at a high, cyclical high relative to GDP.
We've heard that for 3 years.
We have heard that for three years, haven't we?
Again, if we go through our anecdotal database, all you have to do is change the dates.
And it's the same article.
Same article.
So,
and every quarter, our earnings beat this quarter, but it's only because everybody lowered them.
Well, they gamed it. Right, that's exactly right. Well, you know, they beat it because everybody lowered it.
Yeah.
But doesn't that happen every quarter? Isn't every quarter, you start out here, you end up lower, and they manage to just beat that?
Yeah.
So earnings, inflation, what about taper, the end of QE, the end of...
NVR.
That's still going higher, so it doesn't make a difference.
It does make a difference.
So what would it take to make you concerned? What would you need to see?
A significant increase in sentiment.
In bullish sentiment.
In positive sentiment. You know, things like maybe the Wall Street Journal spending more time at the stock market than Obamacare.
Right.
You know, and you know, we've seen a few little ticks here.
Right.
You know, Investors Business Daily has had the market in a correction for 3 months.
Right.
And then last week said we're in an uptrend. Like,
well, which is it? It's an uptrending correction. I'm familiar with those. That's a technical term, you know, uptrending correction.
I think sentiment is the key thing. I think when, you know, like right now, the big concern is, well, too many, not enough stocks are making new highs.
Right. 52-week highs are small. And the small caps are not participating the way the big caps and mid caps are.
The Russell 2000's market capitalization is equal to the five biggest stocks in the S&P.
So 2,000 stocks.
Versus five.
Right, including Apple, which is enormously outsized.
So I'm supposed to lose sleep over 2,000 stocks when I have five winners.
And most of these 2,000 stocks kind of thinly traded. Under $100 million, fairly small.
My big concern, again, will be if I see an article like we saw on April 26, 2010, where technicians are all giddy.
Everybody's bullish.
And all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden my forecast is at the end of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I was
when you're the low man in terms of expectations.
Then I would start to say, you know, now you got to go. It's a little bit
But that's not happening.
It's not happening.
At most, you're seeing just the earliest warnings of that.
Because it's the green sprouts, which could wilt tomorrow.
Right. We continue to see, who just did this piece? Might have been MarketWatch. Financial advisors, RIAs, that lot. Highest bullish sentiment in 6 months. Does that mean anything or no?
No, I really... You know, I have a lot of probably surveys. I mean, the II survey, for example, investors. Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't think there's a newsletter business, a real viable newsletter business. I don't care what.
I agree.
Yeah. And furthermore, if you track the II comments, because they will originally make comments, I think we might have had it in here. One of
the AAII or Institutional
Investor?
Institutional Investor. Okay.
And their comments have been bearish throughout 2013. You know, we have a very high level of bulls, you know, very few corrections, you know, 35%.
Right.
You know, they fought it the whole way. So, again, when my measures of sentiment, you know, start to get skewed, then I would start to get concerned.
And we're just not there
not
yet.
Not even close. Not even
close. So, as far as you can tell at this stage, summer of 2014... This go another 6 months, another year, another
at
2 years.
At least.
Now, what about the argument, hey, this bull market's long in the tooth. It's 5 years.
And the problem is we suggested early on that this was not going to be an average, typical, or normal bull market.
Right.
And that's where so many people have gone wrong. because they said, well, you know, the average bull market gains X percent.
Right. The average bull market is not a post-credit crisis situation.
This is a different animal.
Totally different animal. So how far can how long could this go? Could this be a 10-year bull market? Is that theoretically possible?
Right now, I wouldn't take anything off the table.
Nothing off the table.
I wouldn't buy, you know, 2012 calls.
Right. Yeah.
But last March we were on CNBC and we said 1600 at the end of the year. And more importantly, Barry, we told people to buy this December 160 S&P calls.
Right.
Right. They went up 16%.
So here we are, summer of 2014. You wouldn't recommend buying calls for the end of the year. But you're also not saying take anything off the table.
We're saying our target, since we do make these
multiple targets.
Yeah, because again, we're not going to go out more than 6 months. Right. And we're saying 1380 by the end of September.
All right. So where are we today? The S&P is 18.
No, 13.
I'm sorry. Hold on. Let me pull this up and see what I'm looking at. I'm looking at 1939 on the S&P 500. Right? Not the spiders.
Right.
So you previously had suggested 2000. Did I recall reading you saying 2000 by the end of this year?
No. 1980 by the end of December, by the end of September.
Couldn't round that up to 2000? That would have been a much more so you're spitting distance.
That would have been a marketing number.
That's true. That's exactly true. So you're basically 5% away from that target. Which you describe not as a prediction, but we've war gamed a number of probabilities.
We have bought September 20 whatever calls.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're 30s, actually. September 30 calls.
And the expectation is that this market just continues to grind higher.
And then at the end of September, or whenever we get there, right, we will sit down and say, okay, now let's review things and look ahead.
So I'm going to sum this up. Bottom line, we'll wrap it up with this. So you don't see inflation as a problem. Geopolitics has been contained, and even when it's not contained, it's not spilling over to the equity market. Earnings are at an all-time high, but they have been for several years, and it hasn't gotten in the way of stocks going higher. And the key takeaway, sentiment, which we're starting to see just a teeny little bit of froth, but nothing remotely like what you get at the end. So this bull market can continue for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll end it on that note. Laszlo, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure. I've been reading you and your work for I can't even begin to say how long, which says as much about how old I am as anything else. And thank you so much for coming in.
Our pleasure.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.